All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Oh, man. So today is it. Today's the day. I don't even acknowledge it that often. I guess I do. But okay. I'm 55 years old today. This is my birthday, people. It is my birthday. I'm telling you, because I don't necessarily think you should know. I don't necessarily, I don't parade my birthday around. I'm not ashamed of it in any way. But on some level, I have made it this far, so I should let you know. Today is my birthday. Thursday, September 27th, is my 55th birthday. I was born in 1963, on Kol Nidre Eve. That's how everything has changed. I mean, I don't know what happens with calendars, but I was born the night that Jews around the world were repenting for their sins and fasting into the next day, and I came out crying with a slight eating disorder. I'm happy to be 55. I am happy to be alive. I'm happy that things have worked out for me personally so far. I'm unhappy with the state of the world, but who isn't? What happens on your birthday? I'm sure my mother will text and do her usual leaving a voicemail of her singing happy birthday, which is both sweet and a little off key, but you know, it's not her job to be a professional singer. We'll see what happens. A couple of things I want to tell you about. First, before I get away from myself here and start talking about me, I'd like to say that my guest is Gail Ann Hurd, a film producer, a TV producer. She's produced amazing blockbuster movies, The Terminator, The Abyss, Aliens, Armageddon. She's a producer of The Walking Dead. But she's here today. I got an opportunity to talk to her, and I'm like, I don't talk to many producers. And this should be pretty interesting. So that's happening. That's going to happen for all of us. I will be performing in Los Angeles at a small venue October, 4th. That's a Thursday at 8 o'clock. And Saturday, October 6th at 10 o'clock p.m. This is at Dynasty Typewriter. It's down in Koreatown, and it's supposedly a great little theater. I miss the Steve Allen Theater, which is no longer with us, where I could work out stuff. But so I'm going to do a couple of fairly tight evenings of riffage. I've certainly zeroed in on the hour 15 or so that I'm working on as the new material. But it's always good to work out in a small room. So if you want to come to that, I don't know if it's sold out. I don't think it is. That's Dynasty Typewriter here in Los Angeles. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for the link for those tickets. So that's a bit of business. Also, October 13th in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm sorry, I'm not doing a second show. New York Comedy Festival, November 10th in New York City at the Beacon, is selling well. There are some tickets left. I would get them if you're interested in going to that in New York. Also, another heads up for New York people. This is not my show, but I think it is a show that would be worth going to in a lot of ways, you know, for several different reasons. It sounds tremendous. It's tomorrow, actually. So you got to go get tickets, or you got to show up and go. It's tomorrow, September 28th. It's at the Knockdown Center in Queens. It's called Flip These Houses. It's a concert celebrating songs of protest and political consciousness. But this is sort of like astounding. These are great old folk songs and also modern songs. I have a song list. I don't need to go through that with you. I should just be able to tell you the artists that are going to be doing Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan, you know, Marvin Gaye even. There's just a lot of different songs that are being covered by Craig Finn, Britt Daniel, Nicole Atkins, Ted Leo, Laura Cantrell are a few of the performers. As I said before, they're going to be doing songs by Bob Dylan, Patti Smith, David Bowie, Nina Simone, dozens more. The goal is to support Get Out the Vote campaigns, with proceeds going to Power the Polls, The Hometown Project, Rise and Resist, and the Center for Popular Democracy. Go to flipthesehouses.org for tickets. Again, this is at the Knockdown Center in Queens tomorrow night, Friday, September 28th. It should be a pretty amazing show. I think a lot of people may not even be conscious of some of the amazing songs that happened way back in the day. Sounds like a nice day, nice evening. Go see it. I think I told you some of you guys, I've been going to doctors a bit. Not because I'm losing my mind, just because, you go get a checkup. And I've had this thing on my head, and I think I reflected on some oddball late stage George Carlin bit where he talks about just noticing a bump on your head. Well, it happened to me. It happened, and I was playing with it, and I was hitting it with my comb, and of course, I was nervous about it. When a bump arises, you want to get it dealt with. Don't let your bump sit. Okay, folks, if I can say anything today, it's don't let the bump sit and fester. Don't wait till the bump gets bigger. If a bump is there and a bump wasn't there before and you know it not to be a pimple, go get it checked. So I went to my skin doctor and because I didn't know, is this a cancer bump or is it just one of the general old man bumps? Because the old man bumps and spots start to happen after a certain age. I know this is a very sexy conversation I'm having with you people. I know it's something you want to hear. Old man bumps and spots do start to surface. So she took one look at it, said it was an old man bump. It has a clinical name, but that's what I'll call it. And then she said, you want me to burn it off? You want me to knock it out? You want me to freeze that baby? I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. And then she walked out. I'm like, yo, wait, you know what? Let's freeze it off. So now I'm waiting for my old man bump to come off. Exciting stuff, right? Happy birthday to me. I'm trying to get to know my new neighborhood, but I'm walking around. It's a nice neighborhood. You know, it's not insanely fancy, but it's a nice neighborhood. But here's an interesting thing you can do when you walk around your neighborhood. Look at telephone poles. Look at what's posted on telephone poles. And, you know, if it's just a random poem or perhaps rambling of a schizophrenic mind that's just there on the pole, it makes you wonder, hey, who are my neighbors? Is this something they wrote? Is it something that, I just saw this. It was actually someone came over to the house and they parked across the street in the wrong place. And they were visiting my house, a future guest. All right, it was Anna Faris. And she goes, I thought you lived in this house because of this thing that was on the posted on the telephone pole. It just here, I'll read it to you. An unsatiated full tilt feeding frenzy has thus begun on cereal box tops, on still barely writhing earthen complexion. These insects, as children, pick over the red fire, soft and gelatinous corpse of an octopus, leaving its newly dug hole exposed for their own entertainment. In tattered, splintered array, this playground of a shipwreck, the only failure within miles to serve due purpose and instead danced upon till inches and inches slowly sink deeper. Does quicksand really exist? This was the village it took to pick over mankind's foibles and ultimate lack of progression. For in youth, unless it be mother, elderism doesn't stand a chance. And then it just says, Suter, I guess, is the author. But this was on a telephone pole stapled in my nice, relatively suburban neighborhood. And for some reason that made Anna Faris thought that I was the author and she must be at my house. So that's made my neighborhood a little mysterious to me. I will do more research. That I will tell you. I hope it's not wrong of me to read the poetry posted on telephone poles. I didn't quite understand it. Not sure why I read it. It all just happened. So what else do I want to tell you? Health things. I smashed my finger this morning. Yeah, smashed it. I was working out. I've been compulsively working out. I have to admit that I've been locked into a fairly regimented eating situation. I've trimmed down a bit and I've been just exercising like a fucking lunatic. And somehow or another, I was dropping some barbells as I was laying on a bench press. And I guess there were some other barbells there where I dropped it. It bounced up, smashed my index finger between one barbell and another by complete fucking ridiculous coincidence. How do these things time out right? But there's that moment You know that moment when you hurt yourself and, you know, if you're lucky, it's not major. But, you know, even if it is major, it's like that time right before you get into a car accident where you have about a second to know. That's a little different. But that moment right after something really hurts you, there's a vibration that emanates from the place it went down. Just this sort of like, bang, and your whole, you have sort of a full body tinnitus experience. It's just this kind of like expansion of a pain vibration. And then all of a sudden it converges as I look down on my hand. I'm like, holy fuck. And it's got that weird white color before blood starts happening. And I realize that that nail doesn't look like it's on anymore. Sorry. I'm sorry, you eating? Yeah, it didn't come off, but it doesn't look good. But I guess fortunately I didn't break my finger. But I swear to God, that weird adrenaline and cortisol rush or whatever happens, again, I'm fortunate that it wasn't a major injury, but man, I got jacked. I got jacked. We put gauze on it, and now I guess I just wait. It's just a waiting game. I'm going to wait till my nail turns black and whatever happens after that. And I fucked up my picking hand. So I can actually hear the hearts breaking that there is not going to be any noodling after the show today. I can hear it. Yeah. So happy birthday to me. I get to watch my fingernail turn black and maybe fall off. That's a gift, right? All right, so now I'm happy to share with you a conversation I had with Gail Ann Hurd. She's a big-time movie producer. She produced, a lot. I've mentioned it already in the show, Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, The Walking Dead. But she's got a new film coming out called Hellfest, which opens in theaters tomorrow, September 28th. And as I said, she's also the producer of The Walking Dead, which returns October 7th. And she's a producer of the Amazon series Lore, based on the podcast. Season 2 premieres October 19th. This is me and Gail Ann Hurd. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. I've talked to other people who started with Roger Corman. I talked to Ron Howard, and I've talked to Joe Dante, and I've talked to Roger Corman. And you started there.
I did. That was my first job out of college.
Where'd you go to college?
Stanford.
Really?
That was Roger's alma mater.
It was?
Yes. He has a degree in chemical engineering.
That's right.
Yes.
Did you grow up in Los Angeles?
I was born in L.A., fourth generation, Los Angelina.
Wow. Yeah.
And but my parents moved to Palm Springs, so I actually graduated from Palm Springs High School.
Palm Springs. I can't imagine growing up there. Was it nice?
Nor could I.
Yeah.
And I did, so.
But like, what was that community like? It's just like retired people and show business. Like, I can't imagine.
That's what people don't understand is that the economy that is required to support golf courses and hotels and all of that is a very blue-collar community.
Sure, right.
And it's very multi-ethnic.
Yeah.
So it's not what people think. I mean, the wealthy families.
Yeah.
Didn't stay there year-round and have their kids go to Palm Springs High School.
Right, so there was definitely this class divide.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was like the resort people, and then there was the working people.
Yeah, they're the townies,
and
then the out-of-townies.
Right, right. So there's almost like a summer camp kind of vibe. Like, people would come every year, and there'd be like weird relationships between, I'm just talking about kids.
You know, we didn't meet the people who were from out of town. No. No, because they had a totally different social
right
circle than we did.
Yeah.
So we were the locals. We hung out together, and we tried to leave town for spring break or the other, you know, big weekends
right.
or weeks that people would come and invade.
And ruin the town?
Yeah, we looked at it that way.
And what was your dad, what was business was your folks in?
My dad had retired, uh-huh. and he had been in real estate.
Yeah, here in L.A.?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And then my mother had been his secretary.
And that, oh, the old school.
Very old school.
But you went to Stanford, so what was your big plan?
I wanted to be a marine biologist.
Oh, well, you made the abyss.
I did. So, you know, that was my one contribution to marine sciences.
Did you study it? Did you go full on?
I wasn't that smart.
Oh, it was just
no.
Right,
the sciences at Stanford.
Yeah.
I mean,
I
did really well in the humanities.
Right. Yeah.
But I was definitely not the caliber to succeed in
yeah.
math and science.
So you didn't do any of the sciences?
Well, I took calculus and I took a couple of other courses, and I took intro to yeah. computing.
Oh yeah, and that was like a new thing then.
That was when they had punch cards,
right?
And we learned Algol W programming language,
uh-huh.
And the IBM 360,
the giant
computer that literally was less than the computing power of your phone.
That's crazy.
Took up an entire building,
and you learned that and how to work one of those or how to program
yes,
it.
Yes, so I did.
Did that come in handy?
No,
but it acquainted you with the machinery.
It made me fear technology.
Yeah.
I mean, when I started Stanford, we were still using slide rules.
That's really?
Yes, because I started in 1973.
Oh.
And the Texas Instruments calculator
yeah.
Was introduced, and they were, you know, 400 and some odd dollars.
I remember them.
Yes.
It had pi on it.
Yes.
It had, yeah, square roots, the whole thing. And they were like the nerds that had them. It was like the most amazing thing.
It was. And yeah. unfortunately, that's when you started to see the difference between the haves and the have-nots, because the people, you were allowed to use them in class.
Yeah.
So the people who could afford a $300 to $400 outlay of cash for
yeah.
that were so much more advantaged than the people still on slide rules.
Oh, and they just let that be?
Yeah.
It's sort of built in, that sort of class separation, like that, you know, they're going to succeed and you're going to have to work harder to do it.
Yep.
So when you get out, though, 73, the world's pretty crazy. It's pretty exciting, right?
Well, I graduated in 77.
Yeah.
And the world was pretty crazy. I had degrees in economics and communications.
That's what you came out with?
Yes.
Yeah. And what made you decide to do the movie thing?
When I was in my junior year, I happened to attend a foreign study program
uh-huh.
in England, because that was the only foreign language I spoke.
Yeah, and you wanted to get out?
Big English.
Yeah.
I wanted to see what the world was like outside the United States.
Yeah.
And they happened to have an intensive program in British film and broadcasting, as well as economics.
Uh-huh.
And that was my first introduction to taking film and TV classes.
And you just did it because you were interested?
Well, I did it because I was interested, and also there weren't that many other classes offered.
Yeah, yeah.
And I fell in love with it.
So who was there? Like, what was the thing that kind of blew your mind about it?
Well, to know that I was taking a class where we saw the top documentaries and top feature films and met with the people who created them.
Yeah.
Was really mind-blowing to me.
Do you remember any of the directors?
One of the Asquiths.
Yeah.
We met Sir Michael Balkin, who was the Ealing from the Ealing
uh-huh.
comedies.
Yeah.
And we met a number of smaller directors, and it was co-taught by the head of the British Film Institute.
Oh, yeah.
And documentary was taught by Basil Wright, who was one of the founders at the National Film Board of Canada.
Oh, yeah.
Along with John Grierson.
So it was documentaries that really moved you initially.
Both.
Yeah.
It was both.
And you did a documentary a few years ago, right?
I've done multiple.
Yeah.
I had one that came out this year.
Was that the Man Killer one?
Man Killer, about the first woman elected principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Man Killer.
Now, how does a story like that come to you? Like,
well,
you know,
this is my, that was my third.
Yeah.
And
what was
all
the first
been,
one?
The first one was about the true story of the Navajo who served as co-talkers during World War II.
Oh, I saw that one.
Yeah.
That's a good movie. That was good.
And then the second one.
Didn't they build, they based a feature on that too, didn't they?
That, well, that was not the true story.
Right.
But being
really, that happens in movies, Gail?
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm saying I feel like a fraud, because, you know, certainly we're not going to land on an asteroid and blow it up like in Armageddon.
Oh, I thought I had a lot of hope for
that happening. I know.
I thought everything was taken care of. No?
No. But they do have a near-Earth objects division.
Oh, good.
Well, that's trying to protect us by mapping these risks to, you know, our future.
No real method to destroying them, but at least we can know it's coming.
Exactly.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, that's kind of cold comfort, but okay. So the Navajo Code Crackers was the first doc.
Right.
And
they were all for, they've all been for PBS. And I partnered with Native American women. Valerie Redhorse has directed all of them.
Uh-huh.
And she's of Cherokee descent.
Yeah.
So it was perfect telling Wilma Mankiller's story, being a Cherokee
she
woman.
She was the first president of the Cherokee Nation?
The first principal chief.
Principal chief.
The first woman.
Yeah.
Yes.
And did they, like, when something like that, as a producer, does she come to you? Did she, or were, is this something you were interested in?
First of all, she passed away in 2010.
Oh.
And we were actually approached by PBS, by Vision Maker Media, which is the Native Voices arm of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
And has something like that been something you were interested in before, or was it a whole new thing? Seems sort of specific.
You know,
good.
I read a fictional script.
Yeah.
That was the impetus for me to get involved in Native stories.
Uh-huh.
And I've worked with a lot of Indigenous filmmakers.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed to me that whatever I could do to help get these stories told and to have a wider viewing public was important for me to do so, because heaven knows there's no money in it.
Right. Right.
So these are the most marginalized people, and this was their land.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think we need to remind ourselves about that.
Yeah. It's interesting, because as a producer, you do have the freedom to do any project really that you want. And, you know, and after the arc of, like, you know, science fiction films and horror films and stuff, that, you know, that you start to use your power like that's great. Must feel good to do that.
I just, you know, to me, these are important stories.
Yeah.
And I really want to do things that keep me interested.
Was that always the case?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of times people talked me into producing things that I just didn't understand.
Like what?
There was a movie called Downtown.
Uh-huh.
That I did. And I just didn't understand it. It was a sort of a buddy cop comedy.
Uh-huh.
That's really not, I couldn't add anything to it.
Right.
I couldn't make it better.
Right, right, right.
And so then what am I doing?
Right.
I'm not the kind of producer who just puts my name on something.
Sure. It was too finite. You know, there wasn't, it wasn't of the imagination enough, maybe.
But, you know, I got to work with Richard Benjamin, who directed it, who was fantastic. And Forrest Whitaker was one of the stars.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, what I do like to do is mix things up,
you
know, in terms of working with people in front of and behind the camera who might not have leading role opportunities. I mean, Forrest was not someone at the time who was being cast in leading roles.
Right, right. So let's go back to Corman. So you leave Stanford and you do the thing in England. And then how?
Well, I was still at Stanford during that time.
So last year?
It was my junior year.
Okay, so you come back to Stanford and you're like, I want to be in movies. I want to make
movies. No, I thought that was fun.
Yeah.
I have no idea how to pursue a career in it.
Uh-huh.
So my path was very different. One of my professors was a gentleman who teaches to this day now at San Diego State.
Yeah.
I mean, at San Francisco State, Stephen Kovacs.
Uh-huh.
And he'd been hired by Roger Corman to be head of physical production. And he recommended Roger to me. So I got a letter out of the blue.
You told him you were interested, though.
Well, he knew that I was interested.
Right, because you were typically.
And even though I failed miserably in science and a little less so in math, I was excellent in the humanities. And I graduated in the top of my class
uh-huh.
in the humanities, and Roger was looking for one of the smart people
uh-huh.
from the communications department. And
for any specific reason?
As an assistant.
Okay.
He always wanted people that, you know, he wanted people who were smart.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Look, Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, Jim
right.
Cameron.
Well, were they assistants? Or did they come in
no,
as filmmakers?
No, they came yeah. in as filmmakers.
Right.
But Roger always wanted people who would end up having huge careers.
Yeah, yeah. So you took the gig?
I did. I took the gig as his assistant, thinking that that was going to be my job for life.
Did you like it that much, or were you?
Well, no. I mean, how many role models did we have as women back
right.
in the 70s
sure.
as producers? And I was really lucky that early on, one of my mentors, in addition to Roger Corman and Barbara Boyle, who worked for him, was Deborah Hill, the late Deborah Hill, who, you know, there's a new Halloween coming out. So I really, it's so important to me to keep her name alive.
Uh-huh.
Because she was such an inspiration to me. She co-wrote, produced Halloween, all of those great John Carpenter films.
And was she with Corman as well?
No, she wasn't. But she came and she was filming
yeah.
Some of Escape from New York.
Oh, with
Kurt Carmen
Russell.
And
yeah.
yes. And she hired Jim Cameron to work in the film in visual effects.
And he was at Corman.
He was
at the
Corman.
Time.
Yep.
And he was like, that was his specialty, right?
He was art department and visual effects.
When you got there.
No, when I first met him, he was building spaceship props for Battle Beyond the Stars, which was Roger's homage to the Seven Samurai.
Right. So he was at the Cameron operation when you
right.
got there. Yeah.
Right.
And he was just a model nerd.
He was building spaceship props. And yeah. then Roger, we needed an art director. And since he had designed all of the spaceships,
yeah,
and he could draw,
yeah.
I said, let's give him a shot. So we went from one of the model makers to art director overnight.
When you were there,
and I was the assistant production manager on Battle Beyond the Stars.
Okay, so that was after you. How long after you became the assistant did that happen?
Well, I then was head of marketing for New World Pictures.
You just kind of moved around.
Yes. Wherever there was a need, you went,
uh-huh.
regardless of how skilled you were in that position. and then I went from that to being a PA. So I went from head of a department
to being
a production assistant.
So yeah. you start as assistant, then you're head of marketing. So what were you taking in at that time that, you know, intellectually or for your own business model, his way of doing business start to impact the way you saw how to do what you do?
Well, I think that if you look at what Roger was doing back then, in addition to the exploitation films that he was making,
yeah.
he was distributing Truffaut films and
Kurosawa
films
yeah.
and Ingmar Bergman films.
Right.
So it was very much like, if you want to look at my career, I make incredibly commercial things and then I make documentaries.
Yeah.
So that was a great example for me. And so as head of marketing, you marketed everything from Rock and Roll High School.
Which was his.
Right.
Yeah.
To Francois Truffaut's The Green Room.
Right, because he was like the first distributor, right?
Well,
Janus Films,
I think, predated him,
uh-huh.
but it was really Janus and New World at the time.
So his whole, like, because I talked to him, like, it's interesting that he continued to make the type of movies that he makes, but he always had such amazing respect for these movies that were, you know, much loftier and much more artistically provocative. Do you think that he didn't see himself as being able to produce those kind of movies, or you know?
I think the concern really was if you didn't get it 100% right, it was going to be a failure, because that audience is much pickier.
Right.
And an exploitation audience will at least show up for the first weekend. And if you make the movie for little enough money.
Right.
And in addition to that, you know, he didn't give anyone final cut.
Yeah.
You're not going to say to an Ingmar Bergman or a
right.
Francois Truffaut,
yeah.
you know.
Right.
Roger was never wanted to be Harvey Weinstein.
Right. Well, that's good.
Yeah. In every possible way.
Right. But like he also, like, even though the directors that started with him went on to do incredible sort of auteur type of movies, when they were with him, they made Roger Corman movies.
But Roger was very upfront about that.
Yeah.
In fact, when Jim and I wanted to make The Terminator, he said, the budget's going to be too large. You've learned everything you can possibly learn from me. It's time for you guys to go out on your own. I mean, how many people would say, most people would say, I'll executive produce. I really won't contribute anything, but I'll, you know, take my cut.
Yeah.
Instead, he said, you've learned all that you can learn here. Go out and fly on your own wings.
Yeah. And he did that a lot.
With everybody.
Yeah. He gave them the nuts and bolts education of production or directing or whatever the hell they needed to do. And he said, go.
Yep.
Go. I'll get a new crew of people to make this stuff.
Exactly.
And he was okay with it.
And you know what? We're still in touch. And I see him and Julie once or twice a year. And, I think his name really should be a household name along with everyone else, because I can't imagine the American film industry without the people whose careers he started.
No doubt. I think he is a household name to people who know film.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So when you go to be a PA, is that where you started to really understand the set and how that all worked? What was the process?
Well, I had to do everything.
Yeah.
So I made coffee.
Yeah.
As I recall, the second AD was somewhat dyslexic, so I ended up doing the call sheets because you don't want a call sheet with, you know, pickup time as 6:30 in the morning and, you know, you don't want it to say
3:30.
You
know,
360.
Yeah. Whatever that means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
you'd never done any of this before.
None of it.
Yeah.
None of it. And then I worked with Rob Bottin putting methyl cellulose, ultra slime on the humanoids and humanoids from the deep. And I work with the props department and I work with the costumes department.
Right.
I drove motorhomes. Uh-huh. I emptied the chemical toilets in motorhomes.
Wow.
I did the runs from Mendocino down to the Oakland airport to pick up the cast to bring them set.
Yeah.
And I was working, I mean, I was essentially working, you know, 100 plus hours a week.
But you were also essential to the whole operation. It would seem like when you're that person, it's all kind of moving through you.
Well, I don't know that I was essential.
Yeah.
Every Roger Corman film is essentially understaffed.
Yeah.
So everyone is essential.
Right. But by doing all that, you learned all of it.
Yes. And then on other films, I worked as a grip and, you know, drove the grip truck.
Yeah.
I really don't have as much respect for producers who don't know how sets work.
Yeah. Are there a lot of them?
I'd say most of them.
Yeah, because they're just money people.
You know, or they've, you know, done a lot of development notes and they
come to set and think, and just
tell people, hurry up, how come we're not shooting fast, or not understanding how difficult it is to, you know, to do it the right way and to be safe and, and value everyone who's pitching in on a project.
And who was at your time when you were there at Corman's, who were the directors that were around? Who was working at the time?
Oh, Alan Arkush did Rock and Roll High School.
Right.
And and there was a woman who actually directed Humanoids from the Deep, Barbara Peters.
Uh-huh.
And then
was Dante there?
Dante, I knew Joe from cutting trailers because as head of marketing, I need trailers.
Well,
he was the
trailer guy, yeah.
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 So I got to know all, you know, the previous generation primarily through the marketing side.
Uh-huh.
Peter Bogdanovich
did
St. Jack while I was there. And then Jim was directing Second Unit on a number of films.
That's where he started directing, doing Second Unit stuff?
Yes.
So when did you guys start knowing you wanted to work together, you and Cameron?
When I was the assistant production manager on Battle Beyond the Stars, and I helped him get promoted from model builder to art director.
And is that where you guys started to be with each other?
No.
You just started working?
No, we didn't start dating until post-production on Terminator.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So how did that relationship, did you guys just decide you wanted to write together, or how did it work?
Well, I was helping out because we were so far behind in art department. So I would help spray paint sets and a lot more than you would typically do if you were a union DGA UPM, but Roger wasn't.
Right.
So I literally did whatever needed to be done. And so, you know, spray painting a set, you know, painting a set takes a long time. So we'd be chatting about ideas. Uh-huh. And I mean, back then he already had the ideas for The Abyss. He already had ideas for, you know, films that are being made now that he's producing.
Uh-huh.
He'd had them since, you know, he'd been developing ideas since he was 13 or 14.
And he's still executing them now.
Yes.
That's a lot of ideas.
Well,
and you guys indeed. Are still friends?
Yeah.
Do you work together still?
No, we don't work together.
No?
I mean, he's got, you know, he's making Avatars 2 through 4 or 5.
Is it going to be as big a production?
I think, if not bigger.
Oh, my God. That was such a, the promotion for that alone was insane.
Well, you know what? And we did enter the world of Pandora, and he brought it alive.
Yeah. Did you love it?
I did. I did. Although I have to say, 3D, watching 3D makes me nauseous.
It's a little much, huh?
So I'm one of those people that I tend to prefer 2D.
Yeah. Yeah, do you think 3D is ever going to take take over or anything?
You know what? I am, as we established, not the greatest tech and science person.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to predict.
So when you guys, initially, Terminator was going to be done at New World.
No.
Never.
Never.
But you told Corman about it.
Yes. And he said, that's too big for me. So we took it to Barbara Boyle, who had been the chief operating officer at New World.
Yeah.
Who was now working at Orion Pictures for Mike Medavoy.
And you had the script.
Yes.
And that's what sold it to them?
Yes.
And then you guys were like, we're going to produce it.
Well, they said that they would put some money in for the foreign.
Yeah.
And that we needed to come up with the rest of the money.
How'd you do that?
I bought a desk. Yes. Yes. So when you're a producer and you're trying to get your first project going, you do whatever it takes. And
right.
There was someone I knew had a multiple picture deal with Orion.
Yeah.
And they didn't have their next two projects.
Yeah.
A company by the name of Hemdale.
Uh-huh.
The head of it, John Daly, wouldn't take my phone calls. So I found out that the head of development was a guy named Barry Plumley, and he wouldn't take my phone calls. But then I found out through the grapevine that he was selling a desk.
Uh-huh.
So I got him to return my phone call by saying that I was interested in buying his desk. And I'm also one of those people who, even though I didn't need a desk,
yeah,
I felt so guilty that I had faked my way in that I bought the desk.
Yeah.
But Barry read what was at the time a treatment,
yeah.
A 40-some-odd page treatment.
You dropped it off the day you picked up the desk?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And surprisingly, as I said, you know, he read it,
yeah.
And he called the next day saying he wanted to have a meeting. And that is literally how Terminator got off the launching pad.
So when you presented him with the treatment, did he realize, like, you don't want the desk, do you?
No, he didn't, because I bought it. And at that point, he didn't care. And my check cleared.
And that was, well, there you go. So you were on a business level.
It was a quid pro quo.
Yeah, good. Because I don't completely understand production. So when you do something like Terminator, as you do everything you work on, you know, what are the initial concerns? What do you have to make happen?
Well, when you're making a film with not enough money and not enough time, and it's an independent film, the first thing you have to do is convince the Completion Bond Company, which
yeah.
at the time was Film Finances,
yeah.
that you can actually do what you say, because they're betting on you. It's yeah. like a construction bond, so think of it that way.
Yeah.
That the building is going to be finished on time and it's not going to fall down.
Yeah.
So there was a fantastic gentleman who passed away years ago, Lindsley Parsons Jr., and he's another reason that I have a career, because Jim and I went in and met with him, and he was incredibly savvy. And he asked us all of the difficult questions.
Like
how are you gonna create the Terminator? How are you gonna have the final chase in the factory where there's only a portion of the Terminator? You know, how are you gonna do all of that? And we had the answers. And we even had the locations that we had identified.
You worked out all the effects.
We had, and obviously Jim with his expertise in visual effects.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had the stop motion armature figured out. At the time, we were turned on to the late Stan Winston.
Yeah.
Through Dick Smith, the Academy Award winning makeup artist.
Yeah.
Because we were told that Orion didn't want the film unless Dick Smith did the effects. And he said, I'm the wrong person. I do character effects, makeup, and you need someone who can do armatures and animatronics as well. And he's the one who's turned us on to Stan and said that he would back Stan and I think even give his name as someone if Stan didn't deliver, he would step in. Even though he said, Stan will deliver.
Right, but he vouched for him.
Yes.
And those are the first concerns.
Yes, and so Lindsley completely backed us, and in fact, to the point that when we first screened the film and everyone said, "Oh my God, this is a disaster and it's an embarrassment," Lindsley looked at it and said, "This is going to be a classic, and I believe in you and Jim 100%." So when John Daly tried to take over the film from us
at Orion or where?
He was at Hemdale.
Yeah. Okay.
He tried to take the film away from Jim and me.
And recut it and do whatever. Yeah.
And that Lindsley said, because we were projecting to go into the contingency.
Yeah.
So there's a 10% contingency, that he would take the film away from Hemdale and back Jim and me.
Wow.
So, yeah. I mean, these are the kinds of alliances. That's the kind of support that people who don't know a lot about the film industry.
Yeah.
These are such important people. Without Lindsley Parson Jr.'s support, The Terminator might not have turned out the way that it did.
And you think these people exist today as well?
Oh, there's no question that they do, and they're really unsung heroes.
That champion movies on that level.
Yes. Yes.
And why did screening go badly?
Well, because the animatronics that weren't done.
Mm-hmm.
We still had stop motion animation that also was done by a guy named Peter Kleinow. He was the stop motion animator who played slide guitar for the Flying Burrito Brothers
in
a previous incarnation.
Great band.
Yeah. And every now and again, we'd go watch and play at the Palomino or something.
Really?
I mean, anyway, these were great days. But anyway, they weren't done. So we had lots of slugs in there.
Right.
And so the first screening was really a disaster.
But you plowed through and you made a mega hit.
We did. And because of Lindsley Parsons supporting us.
Yeah.
And Mike Medavoy and Barbara Boyle, we ended up becoming the number one film of the fall of 1984 and made Time Magazine's 10 best list.
Well, it's a great movie.
But we were told before we started, after that first screening by the head of marketing for Orion, that it was a total embarrassment, a down and dirty exploitation film that would be out of theaters after the first weekend because of the poor word of mouth.
What did they know?
Well, I'm just glad they were wrong.
Yeah.
None of us know anything, as William Goldman says.
Yeah, that's true. Well, what was going on in films at that time? I mean, was it a unique film for that landscape?
Well, I mean, at the time, Orion was making Amadeus, which went on to win the Academy Awards, and they were clearly doing something right.
Yeah.
But you know, Jim and I called the nightclub in which the Terminator and Sarah Connor first meet, and he targets her with the red laser dot.
Yeah.
And Kyle Reese saves her. We call the nightclub tech noir, because to us there was a subgenre that was developing of films about the possible dark side of technology that we need to be thinking about. What are the ethics involved in a lot of the things that we're dealing with today? with the rise of AI and the rise of robots. But that's something we were thinking about back in the 80s. And we saw films like, 2001 was an inspiration, and Blue Thunder.
Right.
And RoboCop, I think, I can't remember if it was before or after.
And that
and
one even
Blade
has,
Runner.
Blade Runner, yeah. And RoboCop almost is a satire, almost. It has a satirical element
but
to it.
But it makes you really think about these things.
Yeah.
So,
it's getting away from us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was there. It was brewing, this genre.
It was.
Yeah, of sort of...
And that's why, you know, about a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, when the late Stephen Hawking basically said, we need to be afraid about robots and AI... I'm thinking, if you had just seen The Terminator in 1984, you could have gotten out way ahead of this issue.
It is, like, I was just talking about it to somebody recently, how much we surrender to, just on an informational basis. I mean, if they can really, and I don't understand much, but if they can really teach the mass of the machinery in place to think, they've got everything on us.
Yes.
You know, they can just erase our lives.
So at first the issue becomes who are the gatekeepers, and the next becomes when there are sentient computers, if there aren't already now,
right?
AI,
sure, algorithms that pick demographics that they are sentient.
And as I recall, wasn't there something in social media where they created sort of an AI bot that within hours became started spouting racist rhetoric,
right? Oh, based on what they were taking from.
Yes.
Right. Of course. Right. That's the monster. So that's who's going to be in charge. The robot gatekeeper is going to be a horrible racist.
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah. We've already got a president that's one.
You know, I think just like doctors take the, Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. I think that everyone who's a developer of software, developer of biotech.
Yeah.
Needs to first and foremost think, first do no harm, and what are the unintended consequences of their creation?
Right. Well, it seems to me that a lot of scientists are sort of like, well, that's not, we're just here doing the research, and wherever it goes after that, it's not necessarily our responsibility.
Well, look at
the
nuclear bomb.
Look at
the scientists then who regret.
Oh yeah.
Who regret?
And they knew
what
exactly
they
what they were doing and why they were doing it.
Yes.
Yeah. But so this area of movie making, because when I talk to you about it, it seems like Corman did not, though he made movies that dealt with stuff like this, science fiction movies and certainly movies that were, I think, creatively ahead of their time, he didn't have a unified vision, right? He would make almost any type of movie.
Well, no, I mean, he did actually have a vision. And the interesting thing, if you go back and look at one of his films, which he directed, starring William Shatner, it was called The Intruder.
Uh-huh.
And it was about racism in the South. And it was actually a message movie.
Right.
So I think that Roger always thought about things like that. And I think that there is subtext, if you look for it, in a lot of his films.
Right. I guess I was
not
thinking genre. But no, he always had a good heart and a progressive heart.
Yes.
About the message.
And the fact that he hired women and that women directed in the 70s for him and were editors. And, he really did not look at women as, well, they should be stuck as secretaries for the rest of their lives. I mean, that's what I was expecting. I was expecting to go into a culture in which, I would go from secretary and one day I would be an executive assistant.
Yeah.
That was the level of my ambition at the time. And it was because I wanted to work for Roger Corman and Barbara Boyle and the other people who were running the company that I became a lot more enlightened than I was at the time.
Well, that's what's supposed to happen when you're allowed to.
I know, but we haven't really even gotten to that level now in the industry.
Yeah.
And that was the 70s.
It's crazy. And I mean, a lot of that's coming to head now.
It is, but I think there's a lot of fear out there because it has been an industry in which the people who've held on to power for so long obviously don't want to give it up easily.
That's for sure. And I guess that's the advantage of having somebody who is intelligent and progressive minded and, not an asshole like Roger, who really ran a sort of like, he ran his own show business.
He did. I mean,
right.
At the time, I remember that the letterhead said America's largest independent production and distribution company. And that's what he had.
Yep.
And all of us who worked there, even though we were exploited, I mean, the most I ever made working for him up until I produced a film for him was $180 a week, even when I was running marketing.
Right.
You weren't going to get rich there.
Right.
But if you had the talent, your career was going to get launched.
Right. You were supported there.
Yes.
Right. And it seems like, you know, when I look at the some of the movies that you were doing early on, I mean, they all have, not unlike Rogers, really, that their heart's in the right place. Even Alien Nation's really about racism, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And Aliens is about the sort of, that's about the cancerous capitalism to a degree.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? And The Abyss is about, you shouldn't go that deep.
And I think it's about, you know, we've got to think about this arms race that we're in,
right,
and what are the possible consequences. And let's not always be fearful of the other. Let's not be fearful of, we call them NTIs, you know, non-terrestrial intelligence. Let's not just assume that they're out to get us.
Right. Yeah, that's always the thing. They're going to be bad. I mean, I think what's sadder now is that they may just be like, well, let's not even bother with them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're
on the
lost
road,
cause.
We're on the road to destruction.
Right.
Yes.
And I don't know. I don't know if we're turning back, if that's turning back. But you also deal with that in your movies. Now, when you think about when something's presented to you, I mean, a few of these, Aliens was already the first Aliens. How did you come to get the second one?
So what happened was Jim and I were supposed to make Terminator 1983.
Yeah.
But Dino De Laurentiis preempted Arnold to do Conan the Destroyer, which was the sequel to Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah.
So we had to wait a year.
Right.
So, you know, Jim needed to put food on the table.
Yeah.
And so he was doing ad campaigns, you know, for low budget films. But he was a writer, so he had a sample with the Terminator.
Yeah.
And he went in to meet with Walter and the team, and they pitched him a Spartacus in space idea. And he said, well, is there anything else?
Yeah.
And they said, well, we're thinking of doing a sequel to Alien, which it sounds very common now, but it was very unusual then to do sequels.
Yeah.
And so Jim came back with a pitch. They liked that pitch, and he also was hired for another sequel, which was Rambo First Blood Part 2. So he wrote both scripts in this hiatus between the time that we had the financing for the Terminator and the time we started shooting.
Wow. And this is at that point you'd established your production company?
Yes.
And were you also taking on other projects other than your own?
No.
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 Just you guys.
I mean, it was I had my own company. Jim wasn't a part of that.
Yeah.
And I had an assistant. That was my production company.
That was the whole thing?
Yes.
Yeah. And when does that change? When does it become a larger operation? Which movie does it?
After Aliens,
yeah.
20th Century Fox offered me an overall production deal. And that's when...
Because you were making money.
I was making money, yes.
A lot of money. Yeah. And that's when everything changed?
Yep.
So when a deal happens as a production entity, what does that mean? What's that contract like? What does it mean that they do? What does 20th do? They're going to release whatever you make?
No. It means that you're obligated to, it depends whether it's first look. I had a first look deal.
Yeah.
So I was obligated to show them everything I was interested in developing. They had the first crack at it.
Yeah.
It didn't guarantee that it got made.
Right.
I mean, that's a put picture deal, and
sure.
I never had that. But it also sets forth what your compensation is going to be, and it gives you an overhead, and the overhead will cover staffing,
right?
So that I could hire a couple more people,
yeah,
and I could develop more than just one project at a time,
right? So, which movies did you make at 20th?
Made Aliens,
yep.
Alien Nation, and The Abyss.
And then what happens? Where do you go?
And then, then after that, the late Don Steele reached out to me, and I had a deal at Columbia. And then after that, Sherry Lansing. My next deal was at Paramount.
Yeah, when she was head of Paramount.
Right.
So that
and then I had a deal at Universal also.
So you've always had a lot of deals, you know, moving around a bit.
Yes.
Yeah. And you and Jim marry and divorce in this time?
And continue to work together.
Was it ever awful?
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that we worked together before we started dating.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'd already established
right.
what that relationship was.
Right.
And I think if it had been different,
yeah,
it wouldn't have worked as well.
Right. Do you have kids?
Not with him.
Oh, okay. So after like that relationship starts, it stops, and then you do, how many Terminators did you do?
Five? Three.
Three?
Yeah.
Three Terminators?
Mm-hmm.
Did you write on all of them?
No.
You didn't?
No.
What is your creative input as a producer after a certain point? You don't have, like, you know, you don't get to say, like, well, can we do this another way?
Oh, of course you. I mean, I think that's the value of a producer.
Yeah.
Is always trying to be able to see the forest, not just the trees.
Yeah.
And so I've always been very involved, especially in post-production.
Yeah.
So development notes, helping to solve problems on set.
Yeah. Because you know,
at that point, I had multiple projects going on.
Right.
So I was going from you know, one set to another. And if once film stopped shooting in Los Angeles, it made it much harder because you can't be in. You can go to two sets if they're shooting in the same city on the same
around.
Day. But you can't do that.
That started happening more. Like a lot of movies were shooting away from town.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you had a relationship with De Palma as well. Like, was there a shift from in your mind from doing the type of movies that you and Cameron did to like his more horror psychological thrillers? What attracted you to him?
Brian's one of the smartest, funniest, most engaging people I've ever met.
Wild filmmaker too.
He is, and he's incredibly smart.
Yeah.
And he really should teach film.
Yeah.
If you saw the documentary about him, you'll understand.
I gotta watch that.
It's a great documentary. You'll understand just how much of an expert, not just on Hitchcock.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, being with him was like a graduate course in film.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple guys like that. Scorsese's like that,
yes.
too.
And, oh, absolutely.
And Bogdanovich a bit.
Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, film heads.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you learned a lot.
You know,
about
I did.
Movies.
And we worked together. We made a film called Raising Cain together.
With John Lithgow, right?
With John Lithgow. Mm-hmm.
And so that was a trippy movie. Like, he was, what was he, a split personality?
Yeah, exactly.
How'd that do?
It did well.
Yeah.
I mean, we made it. Came in $1 million under budget. It only cost, I think the budget was 12. We made it for 10 something.
Yeah.
You know, and so everyone was surprised. It came out, did well. Brian's very much a New York person.
Right.
And he moved out here, never really loved it out here.
Right.
Moved back to New York and
so it was a long distance thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He didn't live out here early on too, or no? He was always New York?
Always.
Wow. Yeah, I miss his movies. I don't know, like, I can't remember the last movie he made, really.
Well, he's still making them.
Yeah.
Loves thrillers.
Yeah. Do you like him?
I do. I do love thrillers.
Did you make a shift from sci-fi dystopian movies to thrillers at some point, and then horror? Or were that
you know?
Always,
I
do,
I, the truth is that everyone likes to think that producers are really in charge of their own existence. We're not.
You're sought out by a certain type of filmmaker, I would imagine.
Well, I tend to be the one seeking things out, and it also depends on the access that agents or managers will give you to their talent. So they tend to pigeonhole you.
Right.
So they'll send you the scripts or the creators or the directors who make thrillers or you know. But I also made a movie called The Water Dance.
Yeah.
And that won which is really kind of embarrassing, best first feature. At the Spirit Awards, beating out Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
It won the Audience Award at Sundance.
Yeah. How'd you get that movie?
Because I knew the writer-director, Neil Jimenez.
Yeah.
And you know, and once again, it's having people who are passionate about a project.
And that was like a real kind of indie thing.
Total indie.
Yeah. But you don't do a lot of those, do you?
I did a movie called Safe Passage with Susan Sarandon and Sam Shepard.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, I've done a few. I did a comedy. I've done a couple of comedies. I did a movie called Dick.
Oh, yeah, with Michelle Williams.
And Michelle Williams Dunst. And Kirsten Dunst and like Dan Hedaya.
Right.
It was about two Nixon, dog right. walkers to the president.
Right.
Who turned out to be teenage deep throat.
Oh, okay.
Before we knew that Mark Felt was deep throat.
Yeah. How do those movies do for you?
You know, I love doing things like that film I got because it was a parody. Andy Fleming, the co-writer and director, someone whose career started off with a film called Bad Dreams.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had done The Craft. He had done a number of other films. And, you know, it was for Mike Medavoy. So yeah. It was perfect.
So you knew him from back in the day.
Uh-huh.
And you build these relationships over time in this town, for sure.
Yeah, and you know, and if you're trustworthy.
Right.
And you have someone's back.
Yeah.
And you're not a psychopath. Yeah. People will actually work with you more than once.
And they know you can deliver the goods.
Yeah, and then I'll actually be on set and I'll actually do something other than, you know.
Right, just everything okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Fire that guy. I'll be in my office.
Right.
Yeah. And Armageddon was a huge hit for you, right?
Yes.
That was a big movie.
That was the number one. I've had two number one films in the world. The first was, it was Terminator 2.
Yeah.
And then Armageddon.
And those are like, and everybody remembers those movies. Like, it's crazy. And then, like, later, like in the 2000s, you got into the comic book business a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
early on,
I know, and oftentimes I'm too early.
Oh yeah.
So you know, I recognized that Marvel was going to be a huge franchise.
There was
tentpole.
No way it couldn't. Oh,
there
you
was
knew
no
that.
Way it couldn't be, because I read comic books from the time that I was a kid.
Yeah.
I love science fiction, fantasy, horror, and comic books, and the truth was. That Roger Corman knew that too.
Yeah.
And he was also ahead of his time and plus didn't have the budgets to make the kinds of films
that are sustaining.
Well, he actually had the rights to, I think, Fantastic Four and made
really?
A Fantastic Four. And I think Marvel bought back the rights and it was never released.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
But you did, like, it was starting to happen. I mean, did the Punisher or your Hulk,
I did both Hulks.
Yeah. Eric Bana?
Right, the Ang Lee Hulk, as well as the Louis Leterrier, Edward Norton Hulk.
And the Punisher.
Yes, and I did two Punishers.
Is he sort of a secondary character? I'm not a huge comic book guy, and I've been condescending about the genre.
Well, I'll tell you. Shame on you.
I know. I've made an argument on my podcast before about how culturally we've become infantilized, and it's sort of pushed out more of the type of movies that would be engaging for adults.
Well, you know what? That's a point. But the good news is that those films are coming back. I mean, I go to the art house cinemas all the time.
And right.
That's a great thing about living in Pasadena. There are a lot of them.
Lamley is
the
great.
The Lamley and the Arclight.
Yep, the Arclight.
Shows a lot, too. And the truth is, every time I go to the theater, it's full.
Right. Oh, when you see the smaller movies.
When I see the smaller movies.
That's because there's so many grown-ups craving them that even without big publicity budgets, they're like, we've got to go.
There's nothing wrong with that. And I also love the fact that we've got a thriving bookstore next to
the Lemleys.
We've got Romans.
Yeah.
And so they're, you know, and parents are teaching their kids to appreciate not only great literature.
You think?
But great film.
Yeah.
I do. And,
okay.
And you know.
Everywhere?
I don't know that it's everywhere because that's why it's important to go to film festivals everywhere. I'm going to the Heartland Film Festival in Indianapolis with Mankiller. I try to go either Valerie Redhorse or I go to as many film festivals as possible because there's so many places that don't have art house cinemas, and the only opportunity they have to see these films is at a film festival.
Right. I mean, that sort of speaks more to my point is that when you have most of the distribution in the theaters around the country running the bigger Marvel movies or more commercial comedies that are usually awful, and there is no outlet, some of these people have to drive an hour if they want to see a small movie. Whereas it like it should, I think they had a better distribution at another time, or maybe the movies were just different. I mean, there's always been blockbusters or since the 80s.
Well, I think the difference really is streaming.
Uh-huh.
I think, I mean, almost everyone says to me, is it worth going to see in the theater or should I stream it?
And what do you say?
I mean, if I like something, I go, no, go see it in the theater.
Believe in the theater-going experience?
I love
experience?
It.
Yeah, it's great.
I love it. I mean, to me, there is nothing better than being in a theater with people who are going on the same journey with you.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And you don't need to know them.
Right.
But you have
great.
A connection with them, and you can't get that at home on your
computer. Yeah, you can all walk out confused together if it's a difficult ending.
No, and you know, and you go to the restroom afterward, and everyone's talking about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no matter how big they make the screen for your house, even if it takes up a whole wall, you're still not at the movies,
right.
Even if you make popcorn.
Yes, exactly.
It's a communal experience.
So I still, you know, so I was just at TIFF. I was just at the Toronto Film Festival.
That's a big one.
And
with Mankiller? Did you show?
No. Actually, Mankiller screened at Imaginative, which is also in Toronto, run by TIFF, through TIFF, and it's the most important Indigenous film festival.
Oh, that's
and
great.
So we've been invited to festivals all over. We won Best Documentary at the Maryland Film Festival
in
New Zealand.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm going to Iceland with it in a couple of weeks.
Oh, and I bet you're going to meet a lot of filmmakers.
Yes. So that to me is what's so exciting.
That must be incredibly exciting.
When you get to be my age,
yeah,
to be re-enthused about the business, it's important to leave Los Angeles. It's important to get to know the people who are starting their careers now.
Yeah.
And
especially in those communities, the Icelandic indigenous population, the creativity from that area must it's completely different.
And that's why to me it's so important to support things like Vision Maker Media, which is part of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and make sure that they continue to have a budget because we need those voices.
For sure.
Canada does a much better job.
Sure. Canada's doing a much better job at everything right now.
But because they actually finance, I mean, they finance Canadian filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
and not just commercial ones. They finance the new voices,
yep.
and the independent voices, and they have a lot of Indigenous film financing.
That's great. Yeah, and it's part of the national fabric. I mean, there's something about even partial socialism that is sort of like encourages.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
It's important, and we should put our money behind it.
That's right. Well, that's one thing that seems to happen is that when things falter here, people with money and their heart in the right place do seem to step up a bit. But that shouldn't be the only thing that we rely on.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the government should encourage and embrace this stuff.
Yes.
But I think we're a bit away from it. Right now.
Indeed. But you know what? I like to think that that we'll be back on track.
Yeah. No, I do. You have to. We have
to. And that's why it's back to film.
Yeah.
Seeing films at the festival, like, you know, I saw American Dharma, which is about Steve Bannon, which is a very interesting film. And last night, actually, even though it screened at TIFF, I didn't see it there. I saw Quincy, about Quincy Jones, which is a remarkable documentary. And I saw Green Book, the film that won the Audience Award. And that's another film that you have to go to the theater to see when it comes out. And it's coming out from Universal. So, you know, so this is
around.
A film that'll have...
What's that one about?
I had never heard of this, but in the 60s, you know, in the 70s, I remember doing road trips, and you had the AAA guide to, you know, well, the Green Book was for African Americans.
Viggo Mortensen's in it.
Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali.
Yeah.
And who starred in a movie that I did called The Wronged Man, opposite Julia Ormond.
Yeah.
And it's about this unlikely duo where Viggo plays an Italian bouncer.
Yeah.
Who's driving Mahershala Ali, who plays, and this is based a true story, who is Don Shirley, who is the leader, the most important African American pianist and leader of a trio, who'd played for presidents, and had a tour in the South.
All right, and the Green Book is where they could stay safely.
Yes.
Wow. that's a, it was great, great movie.
I loved it. I sat there in a huge theater. It was playing at the Elgin Theater in Toronto, which is generally where people go, you know, 1,000 or so people go to see theater.
Yep.
And it was another one of those experiences. It was the premiere. It was the world premiere of the film, and we knew we'd seen something special.
Everybody could feel it.
Everybody could feel it.
I'm getting choked up just hearing about it. Like that moment in movies
And it's a movie that will appeal to everyone. It's not a movie that looks down on its audience. It's not a nihilistic, film.
Right.
It's a film about we can all be better.
Right.
As long as we understand each other. As long as we can put our sort of bigoted ideas aside, we can find commonality, and it's a great buddy movie.
Oh, that's great! I'm looking forward to seeing it. So the documentary that you did, and you have other stuff coming out now. Like, I guess moving towards what you're doing now, it seems to me that you were able to do with your career, in a very financially lucrative way. Sort of what Corman set out to do in a way, but you somehow figured out, how to do it and make a lot of money.
Well, Roger's made a lot more money than I have, but Roger was also risking his money.
Right.
But
you popularize it, I guess, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you feel like you have a sort of a pulse on why these types of movies, like I know you produced The Walking Dead. And did you have any idea going into that, say, that it was going to be the cultural phenomenon that it became?
No. I mean, back when we were starting it, Frank Darabont and I and Robert Kirkman, who created the comic book, basically said, we want to do well enough that we'll get a second season.
Right.
I mean, that was our bar.
Right. So you don't have any, you're not sort of prescient, is that the word,
no,
where you're like,
exactly.
This is,
you know. And the other thing to remember is that it would not have been the success that it's become if it hadn't been for streaming.
Right.
If it hadn't been for an opportunity to tell serialized stories.
Right.
Where you had to have seen the previous episode in order to understand what the characters are going through.
Uh-huh.
Because people could catch up on streaming.
Right. So AMC has that you can do that there.
You can do that. Plus it's on Netflix.
Yeah.
So people can catch up.
The first season. Every season goes to Netflix after it runs on AMC or simultaneous?
Yes. After.
Yeah.
So last season's available now on Netflix.
I think I watched the first few and then I had to.
No problem.
They're still out there?
They are still out there.
Good.
The zombies are out there.
It just seems like there's a whole, several franchises there, now.
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think that says about... Like, when you deal with horror specifically, that's horror, straight up, right?
Yes, yeah.
What do you think that says about where we are culturally, or in general, why is horror appealing?
Well, I'm not a sociologist.
But, you make the movies.
But I think that when people have the level of insecurity that we all have right now about the state of the world,
right?
Economic collapse could be any moment. We're natural disasters.
Yeah.
I mean, you name it.
Right. Why not just take it over the top and have the dead live?
Yes. And that way people can experience this,
anxiety and fear.
And then it's done and it's unlikely that the zombie apocalypse is going to happen.
Yeah.
But, your favorite characters have survived to live another day.
Hope.
And there's hope, and the interesting thing about it is that the Centers for Disease Control came to us and said, listen, we can't get people who are facing an outbreak of SARS or, a hurricane to come on our website and find out what they should do to prepare. Can we do a how to prepare for a zombie apocalypse? We said, sure.
Yeah.
And then they had such an enormous response that it crashed their website. Because people would go on to the CDC website in order to learn how to prepare for a zombie apocalypse.
And then see the real stuff.
And because the truth is, preparing for a zombie apocalypse is very much like preparing for any kind of disaster that you might face.
Right.
Because people are contagious.
Right.
And, you need to stock up on supplies and
So
all
they
of
just
that.
Route them in
yes.
that direction.
Yeah.
Oh, it's genius. And it worked out.
It did.
So a lot more people are prepared for the zombie apocalypse now.
And they're prepared for any kind of disaster that might befall them.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing that they saw that window to promote. Does that make you feel good?
Yeah, because the truth is that whatever it takes to make someone safer, to protect their families, and and not be caught unaware.
Yeah, it's good.
You know, that's a good thing, and that's something that wouldn't have happened without The Walking Dead becoming a huge pop culture hit.
The other two things, like in dealing with this new media landscape, so you become obviously very savvy at that, and it offers a lot more opportunity, I would imagine.
Right, and I've got a show that's in its second season.
Lore.
Yeah. On Amazon.
Started as a podcast.
It did.
That's encouraging.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where's my show?
I know.
I had it already. It came and
went.
Well,
now you've got a huge acting career.
Yeah, it's going okay. I'm doing all right.
Not bad.
Thank you. So how did Lore happen?
My company was approached by Propagate, which is Ben Silverman and Howard Owens' company. They said that they were optioning the rights to the podcast, which we had listened to. And
it's like a radio show, right?
It is literally Lore examines folklore and mythology and tells the true stories upon which those are based.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And
you must have been like,
of course. I love that. What I do when I am not producing is I read nonfiction.
Yeah.
That is my favorite thing.
Yeah,
I love
me too.
Historical nonfiction.
Yeah.
I mean, I cannot get enough of it.
Learn,
So the fact that these were the true stories, and most of them I had never heard of, a few I had, but to be able to explore those on Amazon, and be able to do an anthology series, is something I'd always wanted to do.
And it's a perfect opportunity.
Sure. So Aaron Mankey, who created the podcast, has been very involved. And the first year, we work with Glenn Morgan, who is on X-Files.
Yep.
And then this season, the showrunner has been Sean Crouch, who came from Exorcist.
Mm. From the movie?
No, Exorcist, there was a TV series.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very highly regarded critically.
So these guys, like X-Files and Exorcist, I imagine you hire those guys because they understand to that tonal build of these type of stories.
And they understand... They understand the audience. They have respect.
Yeah.
Unlike some people.
No, I do. I do
okay,
respect.
Okay, for the genre.
Yeah.
And there are lessons in each one. And,
yeah.
And I love the fact that I'm discovering things that I didn't know.
Also, the movie.
Hellfest. Yeah.
Hellfest. So, this is like a Corman movie.
It's like a Corman movie, but it's also inspired by the experience of turning The Walking Dead into a maze. It's the Walking Dead maze is at Universal Horror Nights.
Right.
There's also actually one at Thorpe Park in England.
Yeah.
So this is a worldwide phenomenon. It's not just something in the U.S.
Right.
And
like Universal theme parks, these are theme parks to show.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously there's one at Magic Mountain.
They
got our maze this year.
Yeah,
they've got a Hellfest maze. You know, there's not Scary Farm.
It's not, hasn't even come out yet.
No,
and you've got a maze already.
Yes, of course. And so you know the idea that one of these people in a mask, at one of these. You know, scary theme parks could actually be out to get you.
Right,
was the perfect.
Yeah,
idea.
How has that not been done?
I know. Well,
I don't think the theme parks existed before. Like, you always had the guy in the mask, but he was just in the town.
Yes.
And now that these things exist, they're relatively new.
They are relatively new.
Yeah, but I just thought it was interesting that I don't mean to lean on Corman, but this seems like a movie. Like, it could have been a B movie at a different time.
Absolutely.
You know, like...
I love B-movies.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
so,
I mean, you know, they're raw, they're interesting, there's room for weirdness.
Yep.
Yeah, and
the director, Greg Plotkin, was actually the editor of Get Out. So So he,
that's,
you know,
a wild movie.
Exactly. So yeah. he comes from. I mean, you know,
yeah.
he's got great elevated genre cred.
Yeah, the horror. Like I, and I'm not being condescending to horror fans or sci-fi heads. I just have. It was just a specific movie issue.
I understand. I mean, but you know, honestly, mm-hmm. one of the most relevant films that if you go back and you look at today, which I'm sure other people have mentioned, is Night of the Living Dead.
Oh yeah, well, I like that stuff.
Great.
Yeah, I'm not. I got no problem with horror.
Yeah, the problem is that everyone's jumped on the bandwagon.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who don't respect it, don't like it,
yeah.
think there's an easy buck to be made.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that we'll, you know, that all of us who do care and, you know, love the genre yeah. will hit, you know, a home run every time.
Right.
But at least we respect it and we respect the fans.
Yeah. And I'm a Dawn of the Dead guy. I like that.
Yes.
I like
absolutely.
That one. I actually like it more than Night of the Living Dead. The shopping mall sequence in Dawn
yes.
of the Dead is one of the best things. And also the redneck sequence with the
yeah.
guy. I like elements of satire, and there is a lot of that in horror and in sci-fi, just not so much, I think, in Marvel movies.
Well, I you know, the everything is to me is on a scale.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, and I think that a couple of the Captain Americas have had great commentary.
I got to watch them. I got called out today on an email saying, "Look, if you're going to do this, you better watch all the movies." And then I got cast in a small part in the new Joker, so I'm getting a lot of shit.
But you know what? You can turn it around.
I'm going to have to.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, but on another level, like, why wouldn't I do a scene with Joaquin and Robert De Niro in any movie? But I'm still, like, they're still on me about it, so I'm going to have to make peace
yeah,
with them.
Yeah, you will.
Yeah. And it's great talking to you.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. Nice having you.
Thanks for having me.
There you go. That's it. That's a journey, right? Hellfest opens tomorrow. Walking Dead returns October 7th. And Lore Season 2 premieres October 19th. Okay, no guitar playing. Happy birthday to me. Thank you for all your input on my elbow problem. Holy shit. I'm falling apart, man. Old man bumps on my head, smashed finger, tennis elbow, bad big toes. This is what you work for, people. This is what you get if you live long enough. And it's just the beginning, I hope. Boomer lives! Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.